All right, time for Truth About Markets USA with Max and Stacy on GCN Networks. Stacy, what's happening?
Hi, Max. Kaiser, another week of spilling oil, another week of Goldman Sachs fraud.
Yeah, the two twin catastrophes of our age are coming closer together, the ecological disaster and the economic disaster, which have a common root, the easy money policies of the various central banks around the world, which have caused a financial holocaust. Now you've got various central banks easing their way into positioning themselves into thinking about possibly raising rates at some point. But unfortunately, the social unrest, which is now clearly trending in places all over the world, is going to make that very difficult. So the deflation, Stacy, the deflation is gripping the world. And I see that over there at PIMCO, the world's biggest bond fund, and Bill Gross, who just a few weeks ago said, oh yeah, I'm getting on the reflation trade and the inflation trade, and I'm going to cut my bonds, just decided yesterday to flip-flop and to play the deflation trade and to buy bonds, and that's what we could have told him 2 weeks ago. Either A, he's manipulating the markets and the media to make a quick buck, or B, he's an idiot.
I think it's probably A, because, you know, he was acquiring bonds, U.S. Treasury bonds, when he was telling everybody to dump them, essentially. And this is the man who is the largest trader in the world of Treasury bonds, of bonds. And, well, I think this is a theme that we've been following for quite a while, Max Kaiser.
Yeah, I think more in terms of B, that he's an idiot. Now, unlike if you go back a few weeks to the George Soros, when he was telling the world that gold's in a bubble, and then we found out later that he was aggressively buying gold, then that fits into category A, rank market manipulation. But let's turn to the BP oil spill, shall we? David Cameron, who's the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, took over from Gordon Brown just recently. He has now been drawn into the fray with the transatlantic skirmish that has developed between Britain and America, between British Petroleum and the world. So David Cameron is defending British Petroleum. And this is interesting because Cameron is indicating that, well, why should America be so upset with the irresponsibility of BP? Because after all, we had to suffer. America's irresponsible in the banking sector. Quote, irresponsible, unchecked greed and avarice.
Is this what David Cameron said?
It's one of his cohorts. It could be one of his sidemen. Let's see. Oh, John Napier, chairman of the Royal and Sun Alliance, the UK insurer, wrote in a personal capacity to President Obama to accuse him of possible double standards in his somewhat prejudicial and personal criticisms of BP and its chief executive. There's a sense that these attacks are being made because BP is British, Mr. Napier wrote.
Yes, you know, Max and I are over in Europe as we speak to you there in America. And there is one thing that is being noted in the entirety of the British press. They are very upset that Obama, that Anthony Weiner, that Americans are calling it British Petroleum because they renamed themselves BP. They are not called British Petroleum any longer. They're called BP. So they think they're trying to stoke up, as the press here is saying, anti-British sentiment.
Well, it's easy in America to stoke anti-British sentiment. We fought a revolutionary war over it. Now, you brought up something interesting from our show, Kaiser Report, on RT. The history of BP, British Petroleum's name changes. Take us back to a previous era and a name change, Stacy. Tell the people.
Well, BP was actually founded in 1908 as the Anglo-Persian Oil Company.
Right.
They were operating in Iran, also known as Persia. And they were... The company was nationalized when the democratically elected Mossadegh came in, due to this was the demand of the people, and he nationalized the company. And then within, soon thereafter, there was the CIA coup against the Mossadegh regime or government. And now many are say that it was all financed by BP, which the company at that time was Anglo-Persian oil company.
Right.
Now, so in 54, once they overthrew Mossadegh, they renamed the company British Petroleum. So now they were definitely just occupiers. They didn't have the Persia in the title of their company name. It was British Petroleum, bought and paid for. They didn't have to do any alliance with the Persians. They just took their oil. And then, by the way, you know, many people know of Dwight Eisenhower's warning about the military-industrial complex. And I believe he called it the Anglo-American military industrial complex. Now the Anglo part being this, he was apparently referring and warning about British Petroleum and their use of the CIA and military operations to overthrow a government. And he apparently, this alarmed him, and this is what he warned about for the future.
Yeah, and it's amazing how the setup there is resonates today, obviously, in Iran is still the very much the focus of the global energy industry in terms of various military powers circling around trying to take over the country. They did stage a coup in, what was it, 54?
1953, I believe. And 54 is when they renamed their company British Petroleum, because they had reseized all the assets from the nation and then were able to rename their company.
Right. Then you had the Iranian Revolution, where the Shah of Iran was deposed, and you brought in Iranian Revolution
Well, that's correct, because in 1953, when British Petroleum and the CIA overthrew the democratically elected government, they installed a very brutal dictator who ruled for 20 years and, like, killing many, many, many people, and it was a total police state. It was worse than, it was just as bad, if not worse, than East Germany.
That's right. And this, of course, is underwritten by BP and the oil industry. So then they bring in the Shah. The Shah was overthrown in the 70s. And then you had, of course, that period of the hostage taking, which was part of the end of the Carter administration in the U.S. Then Reagan came in. The hostages were freed. But you still have this regime in Iran from those days, which is now being sanctioned by various world governments. But if you look at the history of this region, basically it's all about the oil and the energy. The America and Britain wants Iran's oil resources, and they don't want to pay for it. They want it for free, which means try a coup. They tried that. It didn't work. Now they're going to try invasion, as they've tried in Iraq, and they've tried in Afghanistan, and so it's all about getting cheap oil. And it ties into a bigger theme, Stacey. The big theme, which we're going to get to in the second portion of the show, which is peak oil. I want to touch upon that because that's a hot button issue. But before we leave this, BP story and the BP rebranding itself as BP away from British Petroleum, I think as the petroleum industry got tarred with being an ecological holocaust provoker and ecological terrorists, there was a need to rebrand the company from British Petroleum, keyword being petroleum, to BP, and then calling themselves Beyond Petroleum or something like this. And it reminds me when Kentucky Fried Chicken, a few years ago, when they decided that the word fried was to be avoided at all costs. So they rechristened themselves KFC. They were simply known as KFC. They renamed the company KFC. They got rid of the nomenclature Kentucky Fried Chicken as a way to stage a public relations initiative to try to manipulate the perception out there that, in fact, they weren't fried chicken in a bucket that'll give you coronary. No, it's actually health food. The chicken McNuggets and the tried and the offering there is actually good for you. Now, we'll be back with segment two here on GCN, so stay tuned. Don't go away, Max and Stacey. Truth About Markets USA. Stay tuned. All right, GCN Radio, Max and Stacey, Truth About Markets, USA. We've got our Truth About Markets New Zealand, Truth About Markets London, Truth About Markets all over the world. Now we're in America. America! So let's continue on this theme of the oil industry, Stacey Herbert. We were talking a big, big story, big news, big trending topic is peak oil. Peak oil is something we've been talking about for a number of years. We made a great film about it, if I say so myself. It's called Peaked, P-E-A-K-E-D.
Yes, you traveled through the Saudi desert on a camelback.
That's right. It was played on international television just a few years ago, and it's available on YouTube. Now, the conclusion of that film and our current thinking is that peak oil, which is the idea that half of the available oil supply in the world has now been consumed, and that the rest of the oil out there, the second half of the roughly 1 trillion barrels that the Earth's crust has created, is going to cost a lot more money and take a lot more risks to find and develop. And it loses its viability as an energy source, because the energy required to drill, refine, produce barrels of oil going forward is greater than the energy you get out of that barrel of oil. It takes more BTUs in than you get BTUs out. And that, economically speaking, that doesn't make any sense. It's like the old joke about the guy who loses 10 cents on every dollar of candy he's selling at the candy store, and he says, "Don't worry, I'm going to make it up on volume." Well, it doesn't work that way in economics. So tell the people more about the peaked oil situation, Stacey.
Well, you described it quite accurately there in terms of, you know, we've moved off the land. There's been, we're exhausting the land mass-based oil reserves. And in particular, you have Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has the Ghawar field, where it produces over 9 million barrels per day. In Kuwait, and that's the other issue here, because many people think, they hear about findings off Brazil or findings in the Gulf of Mexico or places like that. And you really have to look at the numbers of just how enormous the Saudi field was. And that was, I think that was brought online in the 50s. It dwarfs every other major field in the world. The next two big fields are Cantarell in Mexico, which is declining by 37% in terms of their output. The last numbers were 37% drop in output. And Kuwait, the Burgan field. And that was one of the easiest fields. It didn't even need one of those donkey things, you know, that pump out the oil. It just basically, you put a straw in it.
A donkey thing?
Yeah, yeah. You know those things? Technical. You think the things that go up and down and pump the oil?
Oh, you mean the oil pump. What
yes,
do you call
exactly.
That? The drill.
Well, it is called a donkey in the slang. And, you didn't even need that. It was just basically
the rig.
Basically, you put a straw in there. Yeah, you still need a rig. You need a way to extract it. Anyway, let's move on from that. But so there.
Well, you're just zipping ahead, baby. I like it. You're going so fast.
Their fields are declining rapidly. They've announced it. They've actually publicly, officially announced that their fields are declining rapidly. Yes, in Kuwait.
In Kuwait. Mm-hmm.
And Saudi Arabia refuses to have anybody look at any of their fields. So they don't
That's
know.
Right.
But they have. Zapata George, who we talked to, did say that they were talking about, the Saudis were talking about, they are pumping water into it, heavy mm-hmm. amounts of water. And this is always a sign that you're going to have, you could have rapid collapse, just like you have in Cantarell. Anyway, so Cantarell and Bergen in Kuwait are significantly smaller than the Saudi field.
Okay.
So the Saudi field puts out 9 million barrels per day. The Cantarell and Kuwaiti fields, I believe, put out like 3 to 4 million barrels per day, so half the size.
Yeah.
So then you move on to, then you have to go out into the ocean, the deep oceans. And
right, you're moving from the land, and all the easy available oil on the land has been tapped, so you have to move out to the water, the ocean.
First they move to the shallow offshore.
Right.
And now they're moving into the deep offshore. And this was another thing we tried to explain, but it's hard for people to conceptualize what it means to be drilling at 5,000 feet below the surface of the water, and then from the bottom of the sea, another 18,000 feet down.
Right.
They, you know, we have this notion that we're technologically advanced, as President Obama said when he announced new offshore drilling. Now we're seeing that literally there's people just have no way of getting down there. They don't know how to get down there. It's too deep for any human to go down there, or a submarine. They could send down these unmanned submarines, but there's no way to get down there. And this is the real cost of oil.
Right, they're pushing into the water because all the easy available oil on land is essentially tapped out because of peak oil, because they've hit that barrier of the all the easily, first half, as it's called, the first half of all the oil reserves that are available are done, they're spent.
Yes, because there comes a certain point where you're just spending more in BTUs and costs because, you know, the cost of drilling out there is huge. You reach when it starts to take you more energy to extract that barrel of oil. When it takes more than a barrel of oil to extract a barrel of oil.
And energy-wise, yeah. So, you know, here's my question, though. Why is it so difficult for people... ordinary people of you know, moderate to above average intelligence to wrap their mind around the fact that oil is a finite resource? Why is that such a hard concept for people to wrap their mind around? I mean, I have my theories, but what do you think?
Well, I think it's a number of reasons. I think it's partly to do with there's a real hostility towards nature, the fact that it could possibly be more powerful than humans, that somehow, you know, God would never allow us, you know, the earth was given to us to exploit forever. And there could be no shortage ever of any natural product. And because there's also this notion that it's a conspiracy for oil companies to raise their price of oil or something. And I'm sure that's what BP is really happy with, the cost to this. They're about to go bankrupt or out of business.
Yeah.
And that shows you the conspiracy, that they were just seeking to put themselves out of business.
Yeah, well, you know, my feeling about it is why there's such a resistance, you know, to the peak oil truth. About is exactly similar to what you're saying. In other words, there's an inability for the modern era, you know, the post-oil era, this past 100 years of incredible growth of the airplane and the rocket ships and mass transit and the automobile becoming affordable by the masses. There's just a real slap in the face that, in fact, that entire 100-year history of economic quote-unquote progress is tied to a finite resources, which is now running out. And it would mean a complete change, a 100-year shift in mentality, that people would have to just radically, completely rethink their lives, because oil and the cheap oil, especially in the United States, where oil is kept artificially low because of America's imperial quest around the globe and going into places like Iraq and others. This is
nominally on the surface, it looks cheap.
Yeah,
but you have to count in the cost of the military, which everybody knows the U.S. spends more than, like, now it's like 75% of the world combined on military, and then the cost of these sort of cleanups. Nobody counts those costs, but those are real.
Yeah, I think we should touch on this, the real cost of oil exploration. When we come back here, GCN Networks, Max and Stacey, Truth About Markets USA.
All right, it's Truth About Markets USA, Max and Stacey. And we're talking about oil, peak oil, BP, and the true cost of oil. Because in the United States, the price of a gallon of gas is, what, $2.50, $3 a gallon of gas, which is cheaper than anywhere else in the industrialized world, where they pay $8, $9, $10 a gallon, including, of course, heavy taxes that are used to... refinance aspects of their societies in Europe and in other places. In the U.S., it's cheap. And, of course, that has a lot to do with America's imperial conquest of territories that are rich in oil and doing backroom deals with companies that are also involved in imperial conquest, like Chevron and the Niger Delta. You know, their banking facilities are engineered by Wall Street, so there's a lot of overlap there between various oil companies. But, as we were saying before the break, these wars, this trillion-dollar Pentagon budget, is not exactly not a cost that's now cutting into quality of life in the U.S., Stacey.
Well, there's also another fact that came out this week, which is the EIA, the Energy Information Agency, which is part of the Department of Energy, and they produce an annual report on the energy outlook. And for the, they've finally lowered their estimates of production because they've always been far over. Their estimates for the last basically 20 years have been always optimistic. They've always like overshot by 20, 30%.
Okay, so just to put this in context, so the world consumes roughly 85 million barrels a day, and the world is producing roughly 85 million barrels a day of oil, and that production number has been going up according to this agency. But you're saying now that they've pulled back?
They're now pulling back to, you know, there are many groups that you know, look at the outlook for energy production. And this includes all energy. They're looking at liquids, including oil and natural gas, to coal and other things. But they've finally come down a little bit more in line with other groups that look at oil output. And they've always, you know, most of these other groups have said it's not going to be possible to produce the amount of oil that the EIA has said, especially under Dick Cheney. They surged. They went wildly optimistic that there was going to be like 110 million barrels of oil produced per day by 2010, by mm-hmm. where we are now. So obviously that hasn't happened. But there is this report is available online. They've just released this. This is a 2010 Energy Outlook. And the numbers are that with liquid fuels, most oil, it's something like 53% at this point, is used for transportation.
Right.
By 2020, it'll be something like 63% of all oil goes towards transportation.
Mm-hmm.
Because actual industry, energy production companies, like electricity companies and businesses have been at the forefront of coming up with alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
And the other factor is, and this is, you know, a government document and where they project the future is going for the next 20 years. So it goes up to 2030. But, you know, the closer you are, the further out you go, the less accurate the estimates always are, the predictions always are. But they see a huge increase in coal. People are just for energy use, for electricity, producing electricity. And the other reason why they see the use of oil is so extravagant is actually not so much the U.S. where it's cheap, but it's even cheaper and heavily subsidized in many countries, all of the Middle East. We've been to the Persian Gulf, and it's like 10 cents a gallon there for oil,
right?
For gasoline for your car.
Mm-hmm.
China also subsidizes their oil, so the price of oil, the price of gasoline there is less than it would be for them. It's actually about the same, a little bit more than what Americans pay.
Mm-hmm.
But they produce less than Americans.
So you're saying on the demand side, the demand for energy is skewing toward coal and away from liquid energy, oil.
For electricity production and industry.
Okay. Because in anticipation of the fact that these oil reserves are being drawn down and they just don't think they're going to have them?
Well, most of it, almost the entirety of it, about 85% comes from China, that mm-hmm. they're going to use it to produce electricity. They're also going heavily into nuclear. Most Western industry are coming up with all sorts of alternatives, whether it's wind or hydroelectric or a more efficiency in using energy. So
right.
They'll be able to continue to grow, but use less energy.
All right. So there's a kind of an underlying theme here that since oil production is running out due to peak oil, innovation is kicking in and alternative energy sources are being financed and relied on.
Well, for industry, yes. Not for transportation. They see a huge increase in use of oil, for example, with trucks, big lorries delivering products to the, you know, Walmart or the, you know, the Fresh and Wild or whatever.
Yeah. Let's talk about oil and Mexico, because this is a big theme. And peak oil, really, in my mind, has a direct link to the immigration issue.
Yes,
you know, let me just set this up a little bit. In the immigration issue, you know, in Arizona, It's a big issue. You've got the so-called Tea Party movement down there. They just voted to allow for summary examination of folks on the street, profiling based on skin color. They want to build a huge wall between Arizona and Mexico. There's a big immigration problem. It's a big hot-button issue, a wedge issue. And the thoughts that are being pushed out there in mainstream media that the Mexicans are shiftless, no goodniks that are just trying to come to America to rip people off. But in fact, if you dig a little deeper, you find some cause and effect here. One is peak oil, which is happening for real in Mexico at the Cantarell field, which is what percentage of the government revenues come from that field? 60%?
Over 60%. And it's a huge percentage of American oil use, you know, gasoline and oil use in America. About, I think it's something, it's over 10%, but perhaps up to 20% of our oil comes from Cantarell. And it's no coincidence, I think you're right there, is that the wall started to be built between America and Mexico. I believe it was the very year that we had the first declines in the Cantarell field.
Yeah, and I think that there is a direct result. Many times, you know, the obvious cause and effect is totally overlooked or propagandized out of the mainstream discussion because it implies economic recalibration, and it implies that some sectors of the economy that have been rent seekers and making huge amounts of profits on an unsustainable situation are going to have to give something back. And of course, they don't want to do that. So they take their profits and their rent profits and they buy the politicians and they buy the media space to perpetrate a myth until it becomes ingrained in society. And it becomes a situation where you have in the U.S. where the Mexicans effectively are being scapegoated because Cantarell Field in Mexico is running out.
Yeah, but and also NAFTA, of course, the first predictions, government warnings that there would be a wall or some sort of conflict between the U.S. and Mexico were in Bill Clinton's, you know, the original NAFTA agreements. They knew that it would drive thousands and tens of thousands of people in Mexico off the land as America dumped all their subsidized corn products onto Mexico. It made it totally impossible for any Mexican to make a living growing crops.
That's right. No, that's number two. They dumped subsidized corn into Mexico, impoverished millions of Mexican farmers who have no recourse but to go north of the border to try to feed their families. Again, engineered by the U.S. Strike number three is the meatpacking plants in the U.S. that employ essentially slave Mexican labor. Until they can not get away with it, and then they have to enter the political system and elect politicians that are going to be friendly to their way of doing business, which effectively is bringing in slave Mexican labor. And then when it comes time to try to give these people some kind of rights and citizenship, they turn their back on them and deport them. And not really because they're concerned about American society, but because they're only concerned about their bottom line. So they've taken a position against the interests of America as a whole. And that's the entire meatpacking business and a lot of other industries in the U.S. that use this slave Mexican labor. Now, we come back for our last segment on GCN, Truth About Markets USA, momentarily. So don't go away. We've got plenty more show for you. This is Max and Stacy. Truth About Markets USA with Max and Stacy. All day. No, that rhymes. It wasn't true, was it?
You're trying to. We have a lot to say.
Yeah. That's Woo-hoo-hoo! Yeah. All right. So I want to follow up on this theme of cause and effect. This is really living outside of the United States as we do. You get to see from the bigger picture some of the fallacies and some of the arguments being made by some of the political parties. Like the so-called Tea Party movement. They don't like Mexicans immigrating to the United States of America. Now, the fact is, the underlying economics that were foisted upon that economy due to NAFTA and the run out of the Cantarell field, one of the top three biggest oil fields in the world, is the underlying root cause of this problem. If the Tea Party had any frickin' notion of what the cause and effect of these economic problems are, they would dedicate all kinds of resources toward getting off the oil addiction, as George W. Bush called it, America's oil addiction. By getting off that oil addiction, they would help the globe get off an oil-based society, and that immigration problem is the single greatest way to address that immigration problem would be to address the fact that you need to come up with alternative energy sources. That's the cause, that's the effect, that's the reality of it, but it requires some thinking, and that's the problem.
Yeah, Max, but that's, I think it's also the propaganda beforehand, this notion that the world, nature would not let us down. We would always have supremacy over it, that we can control the amount of oil coming out.
Well, that, so clear, see, let me just cut in for a second.
Mexico believed it, because otherwise they would have prepared for the collapse in the production from the Cantarell field. They would have been working on alternative technologies and things like that. Instead, they clearly had no idea. It seems like it's genuinely suicidal.
Well, the point is that you're making there, that nature is going to be infinite, and that there's no way that the Earth would diss mankind by running out of oil. You see, that's where this Tea Party movement fails, because they're wed to that fundamentalist ideology where humans take precedence over nature, effectively. And so this is why that party is never going to be able to become a reality-based party, is because they simply refuse to do what they said in the Constitution: separate church and state. That was one of the great freedoms, if you will, of the American experiment, was that you would allow for reason, something that developed during the Enlightenment in Europe, Scotland, France, to have the best of show, to have the meritocracy of ideas drive your society, and you weren't wed to the Middle Age concepts of religious fundamentalism that had kept other societies and other peoples in the Dark Ages. But it seems like the U.S. now, when confronted with these limitations, instead of saying, we have a problem, let's do something innovative about it, they're saying, there is no problem. The problem is that the rest of the world, it's their problem, and they're going to start scapegoating. And this, of course, is a recipe for political catastrophe when you start to scapegoat members of your society, as the Mexicans are being scapegoated.
Well, but more than that, the fact is the Tea Party started out on a very promising note. I remember watching all the early stuff, and they were apparently, they said, against big government and a giant deficit. But I've looked at recent comments from some Tea Party members, including Mark Rubio in Florida, who's being called potentially the very first Tea Party senator. And he's calling for, he condemned Obama's foreign policy and said, basically, he's calling for all-out war in the Middle East and an expansion of war, invasion of Iran. And you're like, what the heck? Do people know that over 50% of our national debt is because of war and the interest? All the $300 billion that we pay every year on interest payments, that's because of war, past wars that we're still paying off.
The reason why the U.S. went off the gold standard was to pay for Vietnam.
Correct. And the U.S. Pentagon budget... See, when they do the breakdowns of how much our budget is, how much we spend every year, everybody concentrates on Social Security, which is dwarfed by Pentagon spending and military spending, past military spending. They never include that in the real budget of the Pentagon.
That's right.
Including the costs of health care for soldiers, veterans. That's always included in a separate budget, which is called health care. So people think that's part of Medicare and things like that. But in fact, if you take out all the veterans' cost, that's hundreds of billions of dollars per annual. So, the costs of war are enormous. If we could cut out even half of that, there would be no deficit. We could get rid of it tomorrow.
Right. The cost of the war is completely counterproductive at this point. There is no unit of gain for each unit of war cost. It's a matter of fact, you get two or three units of negative GDP collapse because right now they just raised the debt ceiling to, what, $14 trillion? They're estimating that it can go to $20 trillion. If you add Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac onto the U.S.'s domestic debt burden, you're talking about almost $20 trillion right there. It's well over 100% of GDP. And for anybody who, you know, would love to see America survive another century, it's almost like that puts us in a position of rooting for an American collapse simply to reset. And hopefully somebody with some brains will step in and restart the American clock and do America 2.0 and do it soon. So you're kind of rooting. Remember during the Bush years, people were rooting for Bush to collapse the U.S. quicker than it was going to collapse anyway due to the debt burdens as a way to maybe restart the whole country quicker than later and get back into the global competitive arena. Because right now the U.S. is standing on the sidelines. They're no longer really in part of the major central competitive action going on around the world. India, China, and these other countries, Brazil, have really taken center stage. And the U.S. is on the periphery now, kind of on the outside of the glass looking in. And I'd love to see the U.S. get back in there and start competing again instead of just throwing up their arms and saying, well, we can't compete. We're too sloppy. We're too fat. Let's just bomb people.
Yeah, but, you know, they're an empire. And every single empire, if you can show me one single empire that gently went away and that didn't end like in a giant collapse because of the very, very same reasons, those closest to the emperor are always the ones that are plundering the state. Mm. And it happens all the time. And it's always the plunder of the state happens always against a backdrop of war. That war is integral to the collapse of an empire.
All right. In the minutes we have left, I wanted to touch on a story I saw in the Financial Times today. Very interesting. The Japanese government is selling bonds to Japanese investors based on their sexiness. One of the taglines for the government's effort to sell bonds to people in Japan, JGBs, Japanese government bonds, is that, quote, women have a thing for men who own JGBs. So the government is trying to get Japanese women to be turned on. It says here, the advert in the free computer magazine R25 features five women who say they would choose husbands who are, quote, serious about money and invest in stability in government bonds.
Well,
you're a woman.
The very, very frightening thing about this is on the front page of the Financial Times. What it really indicates is that the Japanese government is at a, this is peak credit.
Yeah.
And this is something you always say goes with peak oil. This is peak credit. And this is very dangerous for America. This is more dangerous than Cantarell running out of oil, is that Japan is the one totally financing all the U.S. wars, all the U.S. deficits, them and China. But Japan has been the one for the longest and deepest purchase of U.S. Treasury bonds. And if they're beginning to, they have themselves a way far bigger deficit than the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
However, they've been able to finance it because of the massive savings pool in Japan.
Right.
But they're reaching at the very end of it
mm-hmm.
now. And the Japanese citizens are exhausting their own savings because it's a very old population. Now, if they're running out of savings in Japan to finance their deficit.
Yeah.
Right now, Japan only needs to get about 7% of financing from overseas
mm-hmm.
compared to the U.S., which is over 50% of our financing comes from overseas.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that could be a very dangerous situation for everything.
Well, yeah, it's an important lesson to keep in mind. You know, the Paul Krugmans of the world who think that America should continue to go into deeper and deeper deficits to finance so-called growth.
Yeah.
Well, Japan's been trying that for 20 years, and they ran out of all their savings, and now they're exactly where the U.S. is. All right, that's going to do it for this edition of Truth About Markets USA with Max and Stacey. We'll be back next week. Until then, bye, y'all!